a podcast that watched Christmas.
Hello and welcome to episode 52 of If This Is a Podcast Then What's Christmas. Apologies for the gap between 51 and 52. I've got lots of reasons that you'll find unbelievably boring, so I won't go into them. But yeah, if you've been waiting with tenterhooks on tenterhooks since the last one, I apologise. I'll try and make them more frequent now. I don't know. But I'm really delighted about this one because I think we mentioned this at the beginning of our chat, but I'm pretty sure I've been trying for about 2 years to, well, I probably got in touch with him within a month or two of having this idea, and that was back in 2015. So I've been trying to speak to Jeremy Cragen about his career for a very, very long time, and we've been like, should we do it now? Can we do it now? And then it hasn't happened. Lots and lots of times. But Jeremy is the global CEO of Inocean, whose offices in America are in Huntington Beach, which is just south of LA. So he happened to be coming over in the week of England playing Croatia at the football. We mentioned that a little bit as well, not knowing what the result was going to be. So it's a little bit more melancholy now we do know the result. But I'm delighted to speak to Jeremy. Jeremy's a lovely, lovely guy. I've never worked for him, but by reputation and having chats with him in Cannes and wherever else, he's just very popular, very beloved by his staff, is the impression I've had from very many of them as well, and been very, very good at his job. So in the absence of there being some sort of record of, you know, Jeremy speaking about his career and his work and how he CDs, I really, really wanted to get that down on digital recording material, whatever this is. So we went and sat on the beach, and again I think I mentioned that, and let me just apologize a little bit here because the sound levels go a little bit weird and patchy, and I end up having to re-record some of my questions. So I do apologize if one of us gets a little bit loud or quiet at some point. Hopefully it should all be very audible, but you might get someone slightly barking in your ear, so be prepared for that. With that said, let's let you just get on and listen to my chat with Jeremy. Thanks. So I'm finally talking to Jeremy Cragen. I don't know how many emails we've had or how long it's been. So we've been trying to do this, but what would you say? At least a year, maybe?
I think probably about 2 years.
Yeah, maybe 2 years. So Jeremy and I just set the scene. We're on a beach. We're sitting on Huntington Beach, which is quite near, or where Inocean's, is it your West Coast headquarters or your entire USA headquarters? The entire USA headquarters. And Jeremy is the Chief Creative Officer, Global Chief Creative Officer, that's the title, of Inocean. And I'm delighted to finally have a chat with him about his whole career. So when I normally do this, the first thing I ask is kind of how and why people got into advertising. And I've read before that you were very into the ads when you were a kid, and so was I, and I think we were both very lucky to grow up in the John Webster era of ads for kids. But how did you go from liking the ads to maybe turning that into something more of a professional thing?
Well, originally I wanted to be an actor, and luckily I found out quite early that I actually wasn't good enough to do it. And I remember a friend of mine at school saying, oh, you should go into advertising, and I didn't really know anything about it. So I luckily, through a friend of a friend of a father and stuff, I spent a day at the Kirkwood Agency, which obviously doesn't exist anymore, and a man called Ronnie Kirkwood, who in the sort of 60s and 70s was a bit of a legend. So I had a day there, and I just thought, I just love this business. Nobody's wearing a suit. And also, obviously, as a kid, I loved advertising, and actually John Webster's work was like all over my kind of like posters on my wall and everything like that. So to end up actually working with him was pretty amazing. But I did a course called a CAM course, which was Communications, Advertising and Marketing, which was a pretty international course, very diverse. People from all over the world would come to it. Did me absolutely no good whatsoever for becoming a copywriter, but I decided that's how I wanted to do the creative side. I didn't want to do any other part of advertising. And then I did the DNAD course, workshop course, met up with Jeremy Carr, who's my first art director, and we got a job at Ted Bates, which was the one agency. We had a list of the top 20 agencies that Campaign put together. And we had one, we crossed out Ted Bates. So that's the one agency we do not want to work at. And then cut to like 6 months later, we end up being there. So,
So can I talk to you a little bit more about Jeremy? Because I worked with Jeremy at AMV a bit. I mean, not as partners, but he was a really fantastic guy in terms of encouraging us as slightly younger creators and whatever. So what was it about him that made you guys want to work together, do you think?
Quite simply, we sat next door to each other. and we were at CDP at the time. And he was a brilliant art director. He changed to being a writer, and a very good writer too. But I was just so impressed with his storyboards that he put together for this presentation on, I can't remember what the product was. And I just said, look, I can't draw to save my life. You know, how about us, you know, teaming up together? And that was it. Yeah.
And it's interesting what you're saying about Ted Bates, because you know, was it Bates Dorland? Was it that at that time? And where in London was it?
So it was Ted Bates, and it was up at that time up in Euston, near Euston Square. Then we moved to Soho Square, and there was a bit of a transformation. They got in Max Henry, who was just, again, a kind of a legend in his own lunchtime, and every day was interesting there. And then after that, we had Mick DeVito and Derek Day. And so it was really trying hard. And then we merged with Bates Dorland, and then we moved to Paddington. And I think we spent 2 years there, and then crossed the road to Bishopsbridge Road to what was then BNP DDB, Needham.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it's interesting. Did you feel like the fact that you'd sort of turned up geographically within a couple of hundred yards of this agency you really wanted to work at, did you feel like it was sort of taunting you, and you were like, that's the place we want to get to? And saying that, people, I'm sure there are people here who are working in agencies that aren't their ideal agency who want to make the step up. How did you manage to make the step up from an unfancied place to one of the best places in town?
Well, I have Tony Cox really to thank for that, who was then the sort of like executive creative director of BNP DDB. And I think he just had faith in us. I think he just said, if you can do a good ad out of Bates Dorland, you can do a million good ads here. What was quite funny, when we went there to have a second interview with him, he couldn't make it, so he got us to go and see Frank Budgeon, who ended up being our group head. And Frank hated our work. And it was like, oh dear, we're not going to get a job here now. But luckily, then we saw Mark Reddy, and he liked our work. And so I think Tony and Mark kind of like overruled Frank. And anyway, Frank at that time, his head was going towards directions, so... That was 1990 that we started at BNP DDB Needham.
That's interesting. Well, I mean, it's just interesting because, I mean, I'm thinking back through when I've started to see your work appear in D&AD, and it's a, sort of a few years after that that Optrex appeared, and I think the artist impression of a VW crash and things like that happened. So what was the progression between joining DDB or BNP DDB at that time and sort of, I guess, getting to the level where you were starting to get a lot of stuff into D&AD?
I think we had kind of low expectations of ourselves when we arrived, that we thought, look, let's just get a great portfolio together, because, you know, everybody's... I mean, it was just the most amazing creative department there, and I thought we'd never get any work out. And then the great thing is, you see some, like, layouts around the building that you can... I saw better stuff at Dorland's than that. So, and that kind of, like, helps your confidence. And funnily enough, the artist impression was one of the first ads we actually did. It just took about 2 years to get through. And we just... I mean, I remember studying Remember Those Great Volkswagen ads book and just trying to get into that brand, and at that time all the work for Volkswagen would be done at the beginning of the year for the whole year, because there were only like three models and they really didn't have much of a media budget. It's not like now where they've got like 21 different models and everything like that. So it was just persevering, really, I would say, and not getting too scared about being in that kind of environment. And actually, I remember once we did an ad for the Seafish Authority when Job Webster came into our office and said, I love that ad, and you know, money can't buy a comment like that. It was fantastic.
Yeah. I guess in a lot of ways that would be better than winning an award, because, you know, I think, you know, we can maybe get onto this later on about the fact that awards now have become the only real measure of, you know, your success as a creative person, which is all a bit strange. But I think to have John Webster love your ads, is that the one with the paper bag on the head? Yeah, so it's very much the kind of thing that I think he would like to have some sort of humor and a sort of charm in that way. Not long after that, I guess, just again by looking at things like DNAD, Jeremy, did he go off to BBH at that point?
I'm just trying to think where he went. No, I think he went to Lowe's at that time, and he worked with Tony Barry, which was kind of funny because he wanted to be a writer, and then Tony Barry was the sort of like the classic writer as well. So he just had this sort of like thing. He felt slightly disrespected as being an art director, which was kind of crazy because a lot of our work was actually very visual. but I kind of understood why. And he's had a great career and he's sort of continuing to do great work. I mean, sadly, like everybody in this business, when you sort of, you seem to just drift apart, and people who have been close friends, I hardly ever sort of see anymore, you know, and it made and now, especially that I'm on this international circuit, I kind of like I seem to be always in a different country when somebody's having either a leaving do or a 20th anniversary of working together or something. So,
yeah, I think that is a bit of a shame. And I kind of got to the stage where I remember actually at that time, or maybe the time where you were more in charge of the department, it was like there were so many great creatives around and you only really met them at awards dues, and there were half a dozen of those a year, and it felt a little bit strange. And obviously you could be friends and all meet up for football if you wanted to, but it felt like, why aren't we kind of all getting together a little bit more often? But after that, did you then team up with Joanna?
Yeah, so I teamed up with Joanna Wenley, which was great. She was working at that time part-time, so like 3 days a week. So it kind of worked out really well that, you know, I had like 2 days to do some stuff. Then she went on maternity leave, which is, then I had like, you know, 6 months on my own where I did a couple of pieces of work that, you know, I was quite proud of. But, it was good. And it was, again, you know, people talking about diversity now, it actually was a very diverse department then as well, so I kind of still kind of look at it with why are people talking about this, because I just worked with a great art director, whether she was a woman or a man like Jeremy, it made no difference. It was just the talent.
Absolutely. And I guess even though your attitude was kind of in the right place for that situation, I'm just wondering if you were treated differently because you were a guy and a girl rather than two guys.
No, I mean, we were just, you know, treated as a team. And, you know, there's always been a lot of women in that department. But again, you know, certainly when I was running it, I'd just hire on talent. And there were some very, very talented sort of female writers and art directors in the department. So.
Yeah, that makes sense. And just going back into the work a little bit here, if I got the chronology right, around this time, you did those two excellent ads with Frank Budgeon, the Sony Stamina camcorder one and the VW UFO one. What was it like working with Frank, particularly as, you know, he'd been sort of someone who rejected you in your group at that first point when you arrived at DDB?
He was wonderful to work with. I mean, he was very frustrating for, like, heads of TV and clients, because he would never commit to a storyboard. And in the end, certainly on the Sony Stamina one, that our head of TV, Howard Spivey at the time, said, Frank, you have to write a storyboard. So he put something down in about 5 minutes, and it basically was the exact finished ad. and the great thing was with UFO was, again, that was a very strange shoot where we were out in the middle of a place called Van Horn near El Paso and stuff, and staying in a sort of truck stop and it was a 3-night shoot and absolutely freezing in the desert. But he never left his room. He would just, during the day, he'd be taking photographs, and he was so into photography. But it was a beautiful, I mean, it's his voice as the interviewer on that. And what was great was that we were watching it and we were going, oh, we don't need to show the pack shot in this. It will ruin it. And I mean, God bless the client. He was absolutely agreed with it. And in fact, it was only like last week, my guy down in Australia, Steve Jackson, he said, how did you get away with not showing a car in an ad? And I just went, the client. And that just doesn't happen anymore. But I mean, the thing is, I always say, and this is, I'm kind of boring myself with this comment because I'm saying it quite a lot at the moment, is it never matters how much your product is in an ad, as long as the impression it makes is the strongest. So you can put, let's say, a Kia in an ad for 30 seconds and nobody will notice it, whereas you put something in at the end that's only like 3 seconds, but it makes sense of the whole story, then it, you know, then it's warranted. It's the, and sadly, I think that the stopwatch has come back out again for how long a product is in the ad, and certainly not just cars, but...
But I think that leads us really nicely onto your Budweiser press ad as well, which had, was it 10 logos? And obviously one missing, or 11 logos, whatever it happened to be. Did you find the client was really amenable to that because how many logos there were? Was he okay about removing the logo for Prohibition? How did that come out?
I know that it was shown at a kind of an international Budweiser conference and it got a round of applause by everybody, which was, again, another, you know, that kind of is bigger than awards. It's funny is that you know, the great thing about that ad is that, well, what client would turn that one down? I mean, obviously, if they did put the Prohibition one back in, it would have, like, slightly ruined it. And it was funny because there was a writer, who Andrew Fraser, who'd been working on that brief, and he'd said, this brief's impossible. I can't even remember what the actual brief was. And I don't know how I came up with the idea, and it was during the time when Joanna was away on maternity leave. But, I'm still kind of proud of that one, and we still, actually, when we were re-pitching for Budweiser, like, I think 10 years later, we kind of showed it to the client, and they'd never seen it before, and they were like, oh, wow. So, it, you know, it's a proper, I'd say a proper ad in the way that, yes, it won, I think, a silver or whatever a can, but actually, you know, what it did for the company, and the sort of, I have to say, I could loathe Budweiser with a vengeance as a beer.
But yeah, and when I see people drinking it at the World Cup, because they don't have any choice, I look at them and I go, well, I do feel a bit jealous of you that you're at the World Cup, but at the same time, I feel like pity for you because you have to drink Budweiser. Continuing the discussion, I think, of whether you've got products or logos in an ad, one of the ads that had no product at all was Demon Baby. So I was wondering if you could go through a bit of the creative process behind that one.
It was pretty hard, and actually it was also around the time of 9/11, so... it was a point where everybody suddenly went, oh, should we be making this ad? And so it's funny because, I mean, I love it still as an idea. We were really let down by the post-production, and it's certainly, it was kind of wrong at the time. I remember actually having lunch with John Hegarty, and he said, oh, I love that ad, apart from, you know, the reason it's not won nearly what it should have done is because of the post. And, I mean, parts of it are fine, and... But others, I just are like now kind of cringe. But the funny thing was that Pax, the car, yeah, I think the car's bad, yeah. it's in for about 11 frames. And I still said to the client, it's too long. And I said, it needs to be at least 7. But it was great, you know. I love working with Frederick. It was a great shoot in Prague, and we had a lot of fun. And yeah, I mean, again, it was a kind of a brave client. We had left field music on it, and but what was interesting about it, and we did quite a, for that time, I don't think we realized it, quite an integrated campaign before that word had even existed. And we were doing, you know, sort of like Demon Baby murals and stuff around, and it was really there just to, not the brief was not to sell any cars, it was just to make the brand relevant to a younger audience. Okay. So that they could kind of go, oh, Volkswagen's a cool brand, and maybe it sticks in there, so that later on, whether they buy Lupo or they buy a Polo, it didn't really matter.
Well, that's really interesting, because I remember having a conversation with Tom Carty at the time about Demon Baby, and I remember him saying something along the lines of the post not being, you know, perhaps as good as it could have been. And I remember saying to him that I thought it was supposed to be like that, because the whole ad's so weird, so kind of off kilter, that you know, it seemed like the post was supposed to be a little bit disjointed and strange as well. But thanks for clearing up the truth there. And the other ad I wanted to really speak to you about was VW Protection. Because, I was talking to Paul and Nigel at AMV. It must have been maybe 5 or 6 years after it had come out. And they were saying, we were working on something for maybe BT, and they were saying it was impossible to do a good vignette ad. And I remember agreeing with them, but then thinking a little bit further and coming back to them and saying, well, what about protection? And I think the thing is that they are very, very rare. Maybe there's just protection and independent litany. But I think you showed that it can be done. So what was the process of making that like, and especially working with someone like Jonathan Glazer?
Well, it was early, kind of quite early in Jonathan's, you know, sort of advertising and career as such. And he was just, I mean, I remember having a meeting with, again, our then head of TV, Howard Spivey, and we were just blown away by just Jonathan's attitude and his whole kind of, like, demeanour was just so approachable. And what was great, again, I mean, kudos to the client, is that we didn't know how long that ad was going to be. We didn't know whether it was going to be black and white or colour. So we actually shot it in colour but lit it for black and white. And so actually the colour was really interesting. And the client, when the senior client, when they saw the first cut, asked to see it in colour, because they'd always imagined the fire scene at the end to be in colour and not. And they and he, again, a brilliant client goes, no, you're right, it should be good in black and white. But it was... Yeah, it was a really interesting shoot. There wasn't a person every day. There was somebody who was in tears or, you know, injured. You know, the water cannons, the whole fire scene. One of the I remember saying to myself, like, they did another take. They used to do two takes because they were all kind of covered in this protective thing. And one person got up too quickly for the second one, and this automatic fire shot at this guy, and he was on fire and screaming. And I remember walking away from that going, oh, I can't believe I've just written a scene on a script and somebody's died. And it's like it's just an ad. But it was a full-on shoot, I must say. It was great.
Well, that's an interesting thing you mentioned about the relationship with the client, because, I mean, the other thing that stands out for me in Protection is the people who are kind of unsavory characters, like the guy running away from the police in the woods and the demonstrators. And I think some clients would go, we don't want our car associated with people like that, or suggesting it's a sort of metaphor for that. So I'm assuming you didn't come up across any kind of that level of stupidity.
No, nothing at all. And that's what's so amazing. I mean, and now it's funny that you should say it, because you kind of, yeah, why didn't anybody say that? Because they would definitely say that now. And I guess, you know, because... back to your sort of like question at the beginning, that vignettes, it kind of maybe removes it away from kind of like real life and such. And I think, where did we shoot it? In Budapest. And so it had that kind of distant feeling, not that it was at home and stuff like that. But
and was it one of those ads that you felt like when you'd done it that you knew it was going to come out really, really well?
It's still my favorite ad I've ever written, I must say. And I still, and again, maybe because it was in black and white, it hasn't aged.
No.
And I showed it when I was in New Zealand a few years ago for the 3 years ago for the Axis Awards, and they ask you to do a talk, and I just thought, I hate really kind of doing all that stuff. So I did 10 ads that I had something to do with, whether a creative director or as a writer on Volkswagen. And I put in Protection at like number 6, being modest. and it got a round of applause again by all these like young students that had never seen it before. So it was really, really lovely. You know, that kind of, again, made my day, that, you know, a whole new generation had never seen it before.
Yeah, it certainly does have a kind of timeless quality about it, whether that's the black and white or anything else. But I think a lot of Jonathan's work around that time, you know, and before and after, really kind of stands up as being, you know, somewhat timeless. I start to think of the Street Spirit Fade Out video by for Radiohead, and what he was doing for Jamiroquai, Virtual Insanity. So I think he really brought that to Protection, which is fantastic. Just moving on from the work a little bit now. So Tony's still in charge of the agency, the department at that point. Is this where you have the system where you become, I think, what was called a doc?
Yes. So I was like at the beginning of the whole doc system, which is directors of creativity, which was well, it was great because it was a way of people didn't look after accounts; they just looked after briefs. Right. So and it was a great thing that, so actually Richard and Andy, who were younger than me, were my creative directors on Protection. And I was creative directors to them on something else, and so it was the idea about like no egos, and it was very much the kind of the Tony Cox ethos of just hire really good people and let them get on with it, and have fun at the same time, which is something that I kind of tried to take on, you know, when I ran the department. And So yeah, it's the doc system. It kind of really worked, and it created a bit more diverse work, and certainly lifted a few people. There were some people who weren't made docs, and that's why we were all would work to other people, because we felt, you know, it didn't want to feel like a hierarchy or a promotion. It was just trying to make the work a little bit better.
Right, and I guess at that stage there's really only sort of Tony above you in the department. So you've gone from kind of working at this unfancied agency to working at this agency you really want to work at that's producing some fantastic stuff, much of which is yours. So I guess there's really only one step up to being creative director. Was that something you felt you had a sort of deliberate ambition for?
No, and I remember actually one piece of advice that Tony Cox gave me. He said never want to be a creative director. It should just happen. And I remember, so the good thing about the doc system was that you could still do work and improve others' work as well. So there was still that competitiveness. I think the massive difference to being, you know, a good creator director or ECD is that suddenly you take pleasure in other people winning. Yeah. And as a doc, you'd be jealous of somebody else winning and not you. So it worked. So I think one of the first things I actually was a doc on was the Surprisingly Ordinary Prices campaign. And I helped Andrew a lot with some of the writing and stuff. And it was just that feeling of, oh, I'm really enjoying this. It was like sort of sitting down almost, because he was on his own at the time, becoming like a creative partner. But at the same time, you know, I had my name, you know, above his. So it was really good. And actually what was really annoying, I remember British TV, that got ad of the year, yeah. Lamppost, and I got 2 bronzes for protection.
How weird.
I know.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? How, you know, you can look back and see certain ads won lots of awards, but, you know, you maybe have to be reminded of them more than other ones that maybe didn't win awards. And I think protection feels like a classic that springs to mind very easily, and perhaps a little more than Lamppost, even though that's a classic too. I think at this point, chronologically for the department, Larry Barker is arriving. How was that for you, he said cryptically?
I mean, Larry's actually a lovely bloke, but I think what he came in and he kind of treated us all with kind of suspicion, I would guess. And we were all a bit surprised that he didn't really ask any of us what was right or what was wrong about the agency, what things that could improve. And he spent a lot of time, talking to account people and stuff. It was absolutely fine. But I think he came in at a difficult time, because following Tony Cox was really hard. Yeah. And, you know, there was Richard and Andy, there was Dave Dye. It was, again, another sort of department full of stars that were kind of, you know, wanting to sort of keep the standards. And I think it'd been the first year that the Gun Report had come up, and we were one, and then the next year we dropped down to about 18, and that wasn't actually Larry's fault. It was just those things happen and stuff. But it kind of made everybody feel, oh, you know, we're not as good as we used to be.
Right. Just going back to Tony for a second, because he left your agency to come to where I was working. So obviously we both had experience of him, and I've heard in Dave Dye's podcast him talking about what Tony was like as a CD, in that he was very sort of hands-off. And I was thinking about this on the drive down here, and I was thinking, there's a Colin Millwood way of being hands-off. He was the creative director of CDP, and apparently what he would do is you'd come in and go, here's my work, and he'd go, well, it's not good enough, and you'd go, why, and you'd go, figure it out for yourself. Like, as a sort of, so you could be sort of aggressive about go and do it yourself. Or the way Tony was, you felt very much like he trusted you. Yeah. And to rise up to the level of that trust, you had to then raise your game. So I think what Tony did, the sort of, look, if I've hired good people, they should be able to create good ads.
Yeah.
But he made it, and I think he said this himself, it was like topping up the drinks at a cocktail party.
Right.
Is how he considered being a CD. And I think it was very much the atmosphere that was created, and you all felt like, you know, nurtured and kind of respected in that way.
Yeah, I mean, that's very true. It's funny because he made you feel good about yourself. Sometimes it was frustrating because his classic would be, it's good, isn't it, when you show it somewhere. You go, well, we think so, Tony, that's why we're showing it to you. And then you'd find out that he's done a review with all the account team and he hasn't shown your piece of work. And it's like, well, why didn't he? Oh, he preferred something else. And I kind of go, well, that's fair enough, but if he told us there's something else he prefers, we would have gone back and tried to beat it.
Yeah.
But But no, he did just create that wonderful atmosphere, and I think that's a great analogy of the cocktail plant.
Yeah, yeah. And so how did Ewan appear on the scene?
So Ewan came in, and he was working, I think, with Nick Gill at the time in the department. And I remember it was also very kind of like Mad Men, being in New York at the time on some kind of DDB global kind of training thing, and getting a phone call from the then sort of joint managing director saying, do you want to be the joint creative director with Ewan? And I was like, I was working with Joe at the time, I was very happy working with her.
Which year was it?
This was, I'm trying to think, it must have been about 2001, 2002. And I was like, again, hearing Tony Cox's words in the band, you know, you shouldn't want to be one. But going, well, I've got this opportunity now, and like, and in a way, doing it with somebody else was a bit easier at the beginning. Although I subsequently feel that joint credit directors, it slows you down a little bit on making a decision, because you don't want to feel confusing. And, and you know, honestly, Ewan's an absolutely brilliant creative, so it's just the thing that is a joint creative director's. But it was the right thing, I think, at the time, because morale was quite low. For the two of us to try and, you know, bring everybody back up and get the work better. So I accepted, and Joe was a bit upset because I'd accepted and I hadn't spoken to her about it, and I felt really bad about that because I was enjoying working with her, and then it became quite awkward because then she would be showing me work like now I'm her boss. And so, but she then went worked with Grant Parker, who's brilliant, you know, so we had two art directors working together. And they actually did some lovely work. In fact, better work than Joe and I did. So,
yeah, I think the two creative director thing, in terms of slowing down, is interesting. And also, from the team's perspective, I think you find what creative director likes, what kind of work, and you end up going, oh, well, Ewan's in the office. Let's wait till tomorrow because Jeremy's back. I'm sure it possibly did happen. No. But whether that slows it down or not, or whether I don't know whether that can actually work out, because sometimes, and I think Dave Dye mentioned this a lot with Tim Delaney, sometimes your boss doesn't necessarily recognise how great an idea can be. So it can be that you go, well, we're more in tune with Ewan on this, or we're more in tune with Jeremy. It might have worked.
Yeah, it's interesting that Dave said that, because I remember on the wedding that Neil and Clive did, of coming back from holiday, and I use this in my talk again down in New Zealand, and so the boys come in and say, oh, we've done this ad that everybody loves. And I'm like, I've just come back from holiday, so I'm a bit of a grump. And I go, well, I'll be the judge of that. And I was like, oh, I don't really like it. And then they came back again, and I was like, okay, no, I do like it, which is something I've always said to teams, is that if you disagree with what I've said, and, you know, you always come back and say, because you can find somebody in the wrong mood, or they just don't understand it, or they've seen it, or they've missed it in an email or something like that. So, but I also did say that to all these like students, I said, don't ever go into your credit rights and said, everybody likes this, because immediately you kind of go, right, well, like, as I said, I'll be the judge of that. So.
And so the job must change quite a lot once you're sort of at the top of the thing, in terms of not just evaluating creative work, but then you're hiring people. And I think Tony was a great hirer of people. And I think, like, your own experience, he said, if you can do a great ad in that agency, you come here, and, you know, obviously you found Richard Nandy and people like that. So did you have a kind of ethos or a modus operandi about how you should hire people and how the department should be composed?
I just always wanted to have people that really wanted to work at the agency. And, you know, after Ewan had gone, and I sat at the end of the corridor, and I would watch people's body language as they came down, and if there was a strut, I would almost have said no thanks. It was like, and I didn't want them to be so meek and looking around and stuff like that. But I remember Sam and Shish, and that was during Ewan and I hired them, and of actually them, I think we offered them a job, and they went out of the agency and they hugging each other and jumping up and down. And we actually asked them to reenact that for a board meeting, just to show that the agency that was all feeling down on itself at that time, that this is what it means to work at BNP-DDB. So that's what I kind of wanted. And similarly, when we hired Ben and Emma, I remember I'd been away on holiday and come back and the book was there and I just loved it. And I just said, God, I hope these people are as nice as their book is, because that was the old cliche of Bill Birnbach, you know, talented and nice. And I still stick by that now. And anyway, I met Ben and Emma, thought they were delightful and everything. And then they came and joined us and that, yeah.
The rest is history.
Yeah.
And how long were you guys joint CDs before? Did you even go to BBH?
Yeah, he went off to BBH. So I think we were joint CDs for maybe 2 years. He left in 2004, just after we'd won the Grand Prix for Cops for Volkswagen in Cannes. And I think he just wanted to go back to being a writer again and a group head. And then so I think he went and joined, and he worked with Nick Gill back at BBH. Yeah, and they did some really lovely work. So.
And how did you feel? Did it change when it was just you then? And you felt like, I think in some ways it can be, there's no safety net now, there's no one to back me up yet. But at the same time, all the decisions are mine. Do you feel both those?
Yeah, ways? There's a little bit of freedom that you feel. We did have, at the time, our CEO was a guy called Paul Hamsley, who was pretty tough. And actually, I have said to him since, I was a better credit director after he left than before he arrived, because he told me one thing which I thought was really good, is that, Jeremy, you're not just the leader of the credit department, you're the creative leader of the agency, which was, he just got me down to a T then, because I was just so into my department and not actually realizing that everybody in the agency is looking up to that department. So I know that he'd been, so I'd heard that that Paul had been looking at other options and stuff like that. So I kind of confronted him with it. I just said, you know, give me a chance or whatever. And then he gave me some very good, you know, objectives and said, great, you know, at the end of 6 months, and said, let's do it. So, and then he went off and started up Red Brick Road. So after we didn't win the BA pitch, which was kind of a seminal moment of the agency, because I think, had we won it, even though I've heard subsequently that it was always going to be a shoo-in for BBH because they didn't get it the first time, is that I think Paul probably wouldn't have set up Red Brick Road, and it would have been, you know, change of the agency. But we'll see.
Yeah, and I mean, partly I'm wondering if that list of his was generally just down to creative targets, because, I mean, from the outside, it was like a ridiculous award machine. And whether it was The Guardian or Harvey Nichols or VW, where it happened to be, or whether it was, you know, Adam and Justin or Dylan and Fergal or Grant and Patrick or Nick and Simon, it felt like there was team after team and ad after ad. And it was actually, let me put it this way, annoying. The Guardian every year won the campaign press award.
Yeah.
Oh, fucking Guardian again. Not that it was bad, it was just like Jesus Christ. But so in terms of how things were creatively, I think that the standard you reached was very high.
Yeah, no, it was. And I think, again, there's that kind of like balance between competitiveness and camaraderie. And I think people would always want to be the person in the next door office. And we had this wall where you'd always put, you know, the best briefs up and people could work on them as long as they worked on their own brief. So invariably, anybody who got officially was given the Harvey Nichols brief never got it, because everybody else would be after it. And the thing with The Guardian was, I mean, if you think about it, they made like literally 52 ads a year. And if you can't make 8 good ones out of that, then you're doing something wrong. So, and I remember once seeing them all on a wall once and going, because I wasn't running it. It was a guy called Andrew Fraser. And I remember looking and going, oh, that's not good. But then I was like, realised that actually when you just took some of these off and you just left those 7 there, you were like, well, nothing's going to beat that this year.
Yeah. And so were there any ads that particularly stand out from that period that you were especially like, that was the gold standard of that time?
It was interesting, really, because we were very much a print agency. And if you think about BNP in the past, it was very much a TV agency. So you know, I just love the fact that, I mean, some of the stuff that Justin and Adam did on Harvey Nichols, I thought was just, you know, wonderful, like all the sale campaigns and the stretch. Yeah, yeah. And then also the calendar was just wonderful. So I think probably from my time, my favourite piece of work was Night Drive that Sam Ashish did. Because it just felt very different for a Volkswagen ad, but it still retained a kind of a truth. And I remember it being a brilliant example of collaboration with the client, of doing a tissue session. And I'm saying, I don't think there's anything here, because Night Drive started off as being lots of people driving Golfs at night and all kind of like acknowledging each other. And it was just like, it's not believable. But the client, you know, Catherine Wolfe, she said, I think there's something in this. And I said, I went back to Sam Ashish and said, look, Catherine thinks there's something in this. I said, I'm not so sure, but see what you can do. And it was this wonderful kind of like evolution of an idea that eventually, when they came in with the Richard Burton Under Milk Wood soundtrack, I mean, I get goosebumps now even talking about it. I was like, that's it. That is absolutely, you know, wonderful. They ran it for like 2 months, that ad, and that was it. Never put it back again. And so that was one of my favourites. And then also Singing in the Rain, because I think, you know, for populist culture, you know, it won a few awards. It didn't win.
It was under-awarded.
It was very under-awarded. But I've always said, you can talk to people about that ad, you know, 10 years later, and they'll go, I love it. And you could say, and then you can tell them they won a gold Lion or, you know, a gold at BTA. But I think it got 3 silvers at BTA and didn't even get a Lion. So.
Yeah, I just on Night Drive, I think I remember hearing that the original idea for Guinness Surfer was to have Richard Burton reading Under Milk Wood.
Oh, really?
I'll check out, because I'm in the middle of a very long email conversation with Walt at the moment, so I can ask him about that and see if that's the case. But that's what I heard when I was at AMV. And now I'm thinking about it, I can't imagine that really being the case, and was probably So, were you the sole CD there for 7 years, or was that the whole time with you and Ewan?
I think it was 10 years in all, but 7 on my own.
Did you feel like, because you'd been... Did you feel like you were a lifer at that agency?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, like everything in life, that sometimes, you know, when another opportunity comes up, you kind of think... I mean, I can't see myself being there now.
Right.
And I had incredible loyalty for DDB as a network, and there were some great things. But, I mean, and this is no kind of criticism of Adam and Eve DDB, but it was their agency. It was a reverse takeover. There was no doubt about it. So you kind of felt that you were gatecrashing it. And so when I then took on the kind of the international part of Volkswagen and still looking after the UK's work, that kind of... That started to get me thinking about, you know, is this what I want to do for the rest of my life? And I'm so impressed with the how close the leadership was with the Adam and Eve guys, which was never the case really in all the times at BNP. Really, you never felt that you know, as they used to say, you couldn't put a cigarette paper between the three of them. So,
well, I guess that might be the difference between choosing to be together and being together,
yeah,
and kind of putting up with whatever your circumstances are. But I guess those guys are going, we like each other, we think we're good, let's do this.
Yeah,
and then it turned out to be.
I think Ben's been very sort of, I saw him put something on Facebook recently about saying that when bigger agencies buy smaller agencies, they kill them. And he was like, this is the complete opposite for when actually Adam and Eve joined up with DDB. They actually did become a stronger agency creatively, and I think that was true because they inherited some you know, very good people, and it's also great, yeah, brought some great people over. Yeah, and you know, and the John Lewis work as well, you know, sort of has continued to thrive. So,
yeah, and I think there's an interesting comparison there with BBDO and AMV as well, because I think AMV at that time was this, you know, incredible machine of really, really good work. And then when BVO took over, and I was in there, and I think it gradually kind of increased from being quite a small percentage of our work in terms of international and stuff like that to getting bigger and bigger. And I think it's about the networking and stuff. And I think either it was something I read from you, but Adam and Eve's clients were mainly local, and DDB's were mainly international. And I think there's a sort of truism that it's harder to do very good work internationally because you're trying to please too many people at the same time. Do you feel like that's the case?
No, totally. And it was, and I mean, thank goodness for looking after Volkswagen UK, because that was kind of like my drug fix from doing the European car launches and stuff like that, which was, you were always striving for 5 out of 10 at best, really. I mean, we did a couple that were pretty good, but yeah, it is really hard to do international work. There's no doubt about it.
It is, and having sort of been in that place for Apple for quite a few years, and what I've been doing most recently, it's very interesting that we've kind of repurposed international things, and they turn out to be, they probably run better in their home country. But then when we've done the stuff specifically for a country, it's always been much better, because you're aiming at a much tighter kind of bullseye of who you're trying to talk to, and using cultural references that people respond to much better.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, actually, it's just happening at the moment on Hyundai about trying to get the balance right between international and local, because, you know, one of our big markets is India, and you know, what is great about some of the work that we're doing there is it really resonates with you know, Indian culture, which is complicated enough in its own way anyway.
It's like 18 languages.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I kind of look at some of the work that's been done, saying, well, that's just not going to help the brand out there, and so it's just a fine balance, I think.
Yeah, I think we can now have a very slightly 30,000-feet conversation about the fact that has money been the driving force behind having much more international kind of, you make one ad and you run it all over the world, is that kind of thing, or is there another reason behind how that's been the case?
I think it seems to be that brands want more consistency, and feel that it's now, you know, with the internet and everything, that you can Google a client and you might get an ad that's from Australia,
yeah,
rather than from your own country. And I think that they just want to be seen as okay, this is what we stand for, which I kind of agree with, but I just worry that you always end up with vanilla, and that you just don't want to kind of like upset anybody, as opposed to really resonate with something. But I think one of the things we're talking about is actually at least being, you know, positioning the cars the same way around the world, and then letting people, so strategically it's kind of like the same. But executionally, there's enough freedom for people to sort of like execute their own ideas.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So if you position Volvo as safety, that can mean something different in Manila to something in Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, totally.
And so when you took on the overall VW thing, and you're saying there was a sort of a UK thing and an international thing, how was that process? Was it sort of a lot of travelling and talking to teams and
Yeah, there was a lot. I mean, I literally was commuting to Berlin to then take the train down to Wolfsburg, and lots of meetings. But again, we had a very good account team, had a very good guy out in Berlin, and a very good guy in the UK. So we had a lot of fun doing it. I mean, I used to say we were the three creative directors, because they were very opinionated on work and stuff like that, and they could never resist writing an end line and stuff like that, which was quite interesting. But yeah, no, it was a lot. I mean, it was, what was also good is that I could get people, you know, from the Vancouver office that didn't even have Volkswagen, you know, to work on an international brief.
Yeah.
So it was nice to deal with lots of different people, and I think that's what I kind of like about my job now, is that, you know, you sort of like suck yourself into an office, and then obviously you're still talking to other ones, and then you go away, and then you get sucked into like what's going on somewhere else, and it makes the job much more varied. I don't think I could ever go back to just sitting in one agency.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And then how did the transition happen from VW to Hyundai/Kia/Innovation?
Well, it was on my trip down to New Zealand again, when I stopped off at Sydney, and I met up with, do you know Michael Lynch from Campaign Brief, and Patsy Peacock, who used to run FBI recruitment. And they told me about this agency called Innotion, and I was like, huh? Never heard of them, which is really bad, because if I was doing my job right on Volkswagen, I should know that Hyundai, exactly. Yeah. So they said, oh, well, Bob Isherwood's there at the moment as a creative advisor, and you know, you should just try and talk to then sort of like Michael Keane, who's the other guy who's now running FBI on a day-to-day basis. So I had a drink with him and said, oh, this sounds really interesting. Then I was in America judging one show, and Bob called me, and he just told me, you know, everything about InOcean and how it was run and this and that. And I said, okay, well, look, I'm interested. So a Korean came over to meet me in London, who is actually now my kind of like assistant, and she was incredibly honest. And
what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, she just was about, look, they don't, they have no structure. It's because in a way it started off as a media company.
Oh right.
So, and now obviously it's becoming much more full service, and they are understanding all the difference of roles and stuff like that. But she was sort of like honest in the way that, you know, there's a lot to be done, and so I then went over to Korea, and I met Madame Chung, who's the owner, and she's sort of like the granddaughter of the sort of original Mr. Chung, who started Hyundai, which is basically, they're responsible for South Korea being what it is today, along with, you know, Samsung, and it's just quite incredible.
Do they own, like, banks and bakeries and things? Because that's
credit cards, down. I mean, everything, shipping, it's absolutely huge. And so I went and had dinner with her and chat with Mr. Ahn, who's the global CEO, and she said, oh, I'm so glad you've decided to join us. And I was like, I haven't signed. I couldn't really say anything, and so yeah. And I that was in about April of 2015, and then I joined in August of 2015. So I had a nice sort of like summer gardening leave, and went down to Cannes and met a few people from InOcean, and then basically just been going around hiring people and putting them into place, which is, you know, it's been hard. You know, it's. I did say to them, I said, look, hiring me is not going to really make that much difference. It's who I can hire, and then who they can hire, and it's this whole food chain going right down. And I said, the one thing is, I think I can attract talent, but I have to also find talent that can also attract talent. So, and it, you know, it's. It's nearly 3 years now. Somebody told me, Jeremy, don't think anything's going to happen until 5. And I think that's pretty fair. I think we've had some work that's been really interesting. We had some work that I think deserved to win in Cannes this year, but didn't. But I think, again, we don't have enough presence. And we're not savvy enough to PR stuff that, you know, agencies are so good at doing. The big, you know, conglomerates like Ogilvy and DDB and stuff like that are really good at doing that. But I can see it. It's definitely on the turn for the better.
Yeah, and I think you've also got that thing of clients people vote for. And there's a sort of halo around BW or The Economist or Nike.
Yeah.
And people go, just by dint of being an ad from those clients, that it must be good.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, how could it have even been made? And so I think you then go climb a bit of a steep cliff with Hyundai, because it doesn't have that pedigree of awards going up there. Yeah. But I think it's also really interesting that a Korean car company or Korean lots of things company has decided that the two people like you and Bob are the people that are necessary or the right people to take them into whatever their next era is, because to me that sends a great signal of what they want to be.
Totally. I mean, the fact that they'd you know, talked to or got Bob involved, said that's exactly what you said. It sent a massive signal out that they wanted to do something. And Bob, you know, Bob tried to get me into Saatchi's once, so it was actually great to sort of work with him. I mean, sadly, he's not part of InOcean anymore, because I really valued what he, you know, the kind of the PR effect, and also, but he's somebody that I can still phone up now and say, look, you know, there's this, what do you reckon, or this kind of like problem, and how should I deal with this particular person? So it's... He's still very much of a grandfather figure and stuff, and very, you know, but very, very much responsible for me taking the job.
That's great. And just, I think, to sort of finish off, I'd be interested in your opinion of where advertising is kind of going at the moment. And of course, we could spend 3 days talking about that. But I mean, aside from the sporadic kind of nature of the different media that we have to kind of work in, and the number of people who then have to be in control of that, and how a great idea, because I know you like most great creatives. Know the primacy of a great idea is what we want to see everything through. But when you've got several different creative directors in different countries and different bits and pieces here and there, do you think that's getting harder in a way that's going to be difficult to bring back to where it was before, or this is what we've got to work with and we can make it better? Or?
Well, I think... the sad thing about what's happening with the business now is that when you look at Cannes, for instance, is that I would say probably 80 to 90% of what works in, wins in Cannes is not a brief from the client. And that was never the case 20 years ago. And I think if you want to compete against those agencies, you've got to be more proactive. And it's not scam. It's just going to a client with trying to solve a problem that that client doesn't know that they actually have. I'm a bit bored with you know, with kind of worthy work that and good cause.
I know.
I loved reading a quote from John Hegarty in Cannes this year when they asked him if he'd been to the Palais, and he went, "What's the point? None of the work's real." And it's like, God, that's a real shame. And, you know, I'm going to pick Fearless Girl, for instance, here. It's like I was one of the few people, and I love the people who to do with that piece of work. But I'm going, I'm like judging London International last year and going, who can name me that client? Not one person on that jury. And we'd seen that work five times, could still remember the name of that client. At that time as well, the client was being sued for not having enough women and not paying them enough. And you kind of go, and we are still going to award it a Grand Prix. I just don't get it. And we know who the client was for that piece of work. It was McCann Erickson. And I go, I have so much respect for that agency because they turned that agency round and that network round. And I go, well, we're the fools, not them.
They played the game,
and they've won it brilliantly. And so good luck to them. Because I was saying at the same time, if that had come out of InOcean, I'd be as happy as them. But I just going, is this the right way the business is going? And that's why I love stuff like, you know, looking back at the work, you know, Singing in the Rain, for instance, that some kid 5 years later, Britain's Got Talent, copies that dance.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is popular culture. Not just of doing something that, you know, 18 people around a jury table are going to see.
Sure, and bring our conversation full circle. I mean, I remember singing John Webster ads in the playground. And the fact that not only can I remember the ads, I can remember being in the playground with friends of mine singing Hofmeister Follow the Bell.
Yeah.
To me,
and Kiora.
Kiora, oh my God, Kiora. And when I show my kids Kiora, and they're like, no, this was an ad everyone knew Kiora. When it came on,
I'll be your dog.
And it was batshit crazy in a lot of ways, but it was perfect as well. And John Webster used to churn out ad after ad with these incredible, it was the Crest of Bear or the Humphreys and things like that. So to me, obviously, that's something that is worth aiming for. And I think because there's some quote about when the target becomes the measure, it all gets to be totally irrelevant. And now, because winning gold's a can is the target, there are campaigns that are out there that are just trying to do that. And I don't know if it helps our industry, because I don't know if then the clients see us and go, well, you're just trying to do these little, that's what you're spending a lot of time and effort on, whereas you should be solving my problems.
Well, and I've always said, and I'll still say, and I'll still say to the day I die, that awards are a byproduct of our industry, and that, you know, it's great when you win them, and I'm not knocking it, and if we won a ton load next year, I'd be more than delighted. But honestly, I'd be much more delighted to at least try and solve some business problems that Hyundai and Kia have around the world. And
that makes a lot of sense. That's great. I think that's a really good note to end on. And, you know, just to, again, set the scene, Jeremy and I now have to go to a bar in Huntington Beach to go and watch England beat Croatia. I believe England will beat Croatia. Jeremy's not quite as confident as me. But that's what's going to happen next. So whenever you hear this, whoever you are, hopefully you'll be as pleased as we are in a few hours' time. I don't know. Let's see how it goes.
All right. Thanks, Ben. Thank you.
This is a podcast that watch Christmas.